Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Rated G Radio. I'm your host, Garrett Miller, of course, and tonight on our Wednesday show, first and foremost, I want to say a big fat hello to everybody on West Star Radio in the United Kingdom who are listening to us live on your drive time home. I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to tune in. Don't drive distracted, of course, but again, you'll want to be glued to your radio for the next hour because we have the return of Stephen Michael Shearer. He is the author of Patricia Neal, An Unquiet Life. And last time, you know, and I had literally 30 or 40 questions that I wrote up for Stephen ahead of time. I think we got to like three because we just had so much that we were talking about and hearing stories about that were just so rich and fun to just sit back and just soak in like a warm ray of sunshine. Everybody after the show sent me notes and says, we've got to have Stephen back on. We've got to have him back on. And so Stephen has agreed to come back on tonight and continue the discussion. And this is the first time that I've ever had an author come back for a part two of the same book. But we're going to ask for a little indulgence here for everybody tuning in today to say welcome back, Stephen Michael Shearer, for Patricia Neal and Unquiet Life. How are you, my friend?
Well, I am very good, Garrett. Thank you so much for asking me back. I was very pleased with the response from the first episode, yeah. Yeah.
And you have quite the fan base, and everybody, they know who you are. They love your writing. They love your books. And we're going to be doing kind of like a series with you because you've got a couple of other publications that we're going to be talking about in future episodes. So if you like what you hear tonight, Stephen's going to be coming back in the coming months to talk about his other books as well. So if you're a fan of Hollywood history and want really juicy stories, this is the show for you tonight. But again, I was just overwhelmed, Stephen, with the number of folks that sent me notes, you know, because it's one thing if it's like a rock band or something like that, but when I have an author that gets the response that we had when you were on last time, I just immediately sat up and went, whoa, we must have hit, what is it, Texas, California gold or black gold or something like that, but, oh, man, goodness
something
gracious.
Something like that. I know I chattered a lot about myself, and that's very interesting to me, but I also talked a lot about Patricia Neal and my friendship, my relationship with Pat, and she was indeed, for those who didn't tune in the first time, I'll just make this very brief. She was a 20-year longtime friend of mine. I met Pat in New York. And she, when the book came out, she agreed to travel extensively to the high-end venues with me to promote it. She was very pleased that I wrote her biography. It was not an autobiography. That book, As I Am, had been written by her back in the 1980s. My book, Patricia Neal, An Unquiet Life, was a definitive, comprehensive biography and critical career study, which hadn't been done before. For Miss Neal, and after, like I said the last time I was on, after 9/11 events came about that Pat knew I had written and had reviews and minor articles published nationally. She asked me if I was ever going to write her biography, because over the years she had shared with me so many things, so many. Private things, too. A lot of what I wrote, of course, is public knowledge. A lot was researched. A lot was gleaned from her archives, from interviews, etc. But a large part of Patricia Neal and Unquiet Life also includes things that she had confided and talked to me about, and things that I remembered. Of course, I used great discretion and respect when I wrote the book. So I think there are two or three other volumes on her life I could probably put into print, but I think I've done a proper job with Patricia Neal and Unquiet Life, and it does stand, actually, at this point as the definitive biography on her, and she was very pleased with it when it came out. But at any rate, Pat gave me credence as a biographer. I've since done a couple of other books. I have a handful of projects I'm working on right now, and it has segued into other things such as documentary work and wherewithal into the archives and bibliotheques to do research on projects. And so Patricia is my muse, indeed my muse, and I'm always glad it's a drop of a hat to talk about Patricia Neal, because she was a good woman, a fine woman. Anybody who ever met Patricia Neal walked away with that in thought, how forthcoming and good she was. It was interesting too, because when she had her illness in the mid 60s, she had a series of aneurysms and severe strokes. She was in a coma for 2 weeks, and when she came out, she literally had to relearn her life. But I asked several of her colleagues, many of whom are not here with us any longer, such people as Eli Wallach and Bancroft, people who had worked with her, Kim Hunter, if what I saw on the kentoscopes at USC and UCLA, the old archaic film footage of live performances that she did on television, that was the closest, that would be the closest we would see of Patricia Neal after her illness. And I asked people, you know, was she really that forthcoming, opened, and kind of a kind person that we know today? And to a one of them, to the last one, they all said, yes, indeed, she was. She was a remarkable woman, and I know no enemies that Patricia Neal had. As a matter of fact, when I started this book, and I think I repeat myself here, but when I started this book, I interviewed over 100 people, friends, colleagues, Paul Newman. I could go through 4 or 5 Roberts who are no longer with us, Robert Stack, Robert Altman, people that were in colleagues and studied with her at Actors Studio, people who had worked in film, television, and theater with her. And all of these people gave me interview, not because of my pretty face. They didn't know me from Adam. Some of my interviews started before I even had a publisher. But every one of them, to the last one, wanted to talk about Patricia Neal, because she was, like Robert Stack told me shortly before he passed away, he said, I have been asked several times to do interviews with other actors I have worked with, people, these actors who are now gone, and I won't do it. Let, you know, you do your own book. He said, but I'm going to give you an interview, and I'm going to give you, actually we ended up having 3, I'm going to give you an interview because I love Patricia Neal, and she's still with us. So these people, you know, granted me the wherewithal to tape record, to take notes, to interview them. I've never been a starstruck individual. I've certainly always respected people who have worked hard and have become a success in any field that they endeavor, but I've never been starstruck. I waited tables in New York long enough never to be starstruck.
Right,
and,
yeah.
So I asked the proper questions. I pondered and did meditation before each of those interviews, just to clear my head and make sure that I wasn't gushy. That's the quickest way to lose a celebrity in interview. And just get to the point, gain their trust, and get the interview. And these people all gave me, and this was amazing to me, because a lot of first-time biographers don't have that opportunity. And I did. These people wanted to talk about Patricia Neal. They still adored her so. And they adored her before her illness, when she was a hard-working actress. And yes, she did make enemies along the way when she was struggling up the ladder of success. But in complete hindsight and in the whole of her life, looking back, people, you know, certainly had a good concept of Pat, not only as a talent, but also as a human being and a person. So Garrett, if you want to call me back for number 3 and 4 of the Christian Meal, I think I'll do that too.
We can do that too. We can do that too. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I just enjoy so much about the book, and I'll tell everybody that's listening either live or in Memorex here, I'm about halfway through the book. I haven't finished the book. You know, I suppose you know we already kind of know the ending. But one of the things that I've enjoyed in reading the book on for interview one, and then also coming back here today, is that the style of writing that you use is just it's very matter of fact. It's not, you know, flowery. There's not a wasted word. It's just very factual, and it tells just a clean story. So when you're reading the book, you can easily picture her romance with Gary Cooper, or you know, her times in the theater growing up, or what her home life was like. And it's just one of these things that just hits you in the gut, and you're like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen next? So I need to compliment you again for just a fantastic job. You of course were a writer writing many things before this, so it wasn't like this was your first rodeo. So coming into this, I think that you were just the perfect person to tackle this and make it just the masterpiece that it is. So when you were working with Patricia and you were really friends with her as well, what were some of, did you have maybe like one experience with her that you would look back and say, boy, that just isn't representative of what, you know, Patricia is, you know, because you ever, you know, you think, I can't wait to gush about her. This is, you know, fantastic. Did you ever have one of those, this wasn't her best day moment, not to put her in a bad light, but just, you know, to let everybody know that, you know, she was human too.
Well, she was very human. And I remember the night I met her I was doing an off-Broadway play, I think it was at the Harold Clurman Theater. It won the Samuel French Award that year. And it was basically a two-man show, and I was one of the leads. And the theater guild, head of the theater guild and his wife brought Patricia to see that particular play. My partner, Michael, and I gave Pat a ride back to her East Side apartment that evening, and on the way back, I asked Pat, well, was I any good, because I hadn't acted on stage, in about 12 or 13 years. I had done a lot of community theater and semi-professional theater back in the 70s and the early 80s, but this was like 1990-something, early 90s, and I asked Pat if I was any good. And she said, oh, darling, you've got the salt. Well, I took that as a compliment. Eli Wallach told me, and he was one of my very first interviews for the book, he laughed and he said, oh, well, that's an old theater expression. They're just trying to be kind to you. I didn't. I sat there thinking, oh, well, at least now I know that I can act and that, because I was working in corporate at that time in New York. But anyway, on the way back to taking Pat back, I told her that I had recently seen The Fountainhead for the first time, she and Gary in The Fountainhead. And I was very comfortable with Patricia, and she seemed very comfortable with us. And I said, oh, my, but weren't you hammy in that movie? And it got very quiet in the car. I think my partner Michael must have thought I had said the wrong thing. And then all of a sudden I thought, oh, my gosh, I must have offended her. And she looked at me and she said, well, Gary and I thought we were creating art. But over the years we talked about The Fountainhead, and actually The Fountainhead, as you see it more and more, if you can eliminate the Ayn Rand rhetoric, if you do watch it, it's truly an escapist film. She and Gary never looked more beautiful. That was the film that they fell in love while they were making it, and it is a good film. It's good acting at any rate, and it got totally panned when it came out. But she wasn't offended. She just she did see some sort of humor in that, and that is one of the. There were many very personal things that I saw that Pat was very, very vulnerable. She and I shared moments watching movies. I remember one time we watched Ordinary People, and we were at a film festival down south somewhere. And my partner and I had connecting rooms with Pat. We always made sure that's how it was, in case she needed anything, and we were there to take care of her. And Pat and I were sitting, she was in bed, and I was sitting at the foot of the bed, and we were watching Ordinary People, and it just kind of hit us broadside at the same time, and we shared some tears, and then after it was over with, we talked about performances and stuff like that. Pat she could very well perform a great deal in front of people. We heard the same stories innumerable times of Pat talking about her life, et cetera. It's pretty much Pat. It's pretty much standard dialogue that she would give. But we would discuss things afterwards. I remember we were brought to a film festival one time to present an award to a very important actor. Pat had been the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award the year before, and they had asked her to come back and give the award to him the following year. And so Pat asked me to write her speech, and I did, and she was reading it. She always rehearsed. I was able to watch her method at this stage in her life of how she prepared. And she was rehearsing this speech, and I'll just go ahead and say it. It was Mickey Rooney, and I wrote her dialogue. When I was a little girl growing up in Knoxville, I loved Andy Hardy, and I still do. And she said that line over and over and over again. She threw that script down. She said, "I can't say that line." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because I don't like him." And so I said, "Well, come on, we've got to give the gentleman his due, give him a few strokes." But I thought that was very telling because she performed that night, and there were tears in her eyes when she said it, and Mickey Rooney being the consummate artist that he was, there were tears in his eyes when he accepted the award from her, but let's just say there was no love lost between the two of them.
Wow.
And
wow.
They had actually been in this Breakfast at Tiffany's together. Mickey Rooney's performance was just totally panned, and it is still pretty atrocious when viewed today. It's really way over the top. Patricia Neal, you know, as the kept older woman, was brilliant in that film, if anybody remembers anyone other than Audrey Hepburn and George Peppard. But at any rate, not to demean Mr. Rooney, bless his soul, but it's just that I watched a consummate professional working at her craft, and of course watching Mickey Rooney working his craft at the award ceremony. So there were many, many things that Pat and I that I shared and I observed. I watched a lot about how celebrity was treated. I watched how celebrity behaved. Pat could be actressy even with me periodically. There were times that I literally had to walk out of a room when she was in a particular mode. But this is a human being. This is a very complicated person. I think Pat had a joy of life, a joy de vivre, and I know that just being around her, as many, many, many people have told me over the years, "Oh, I met her one time," or "She spoke here, she spoke there." People adored her, they loved her, and I think I repeat myself again. When you would leave her presence, she would probably end up knowing more about you than you knew about her, because she always directed the conversation back to you. But I have talked, you know, all this time, a blue streak, and I really should talk a bit about her career.
Well, I'd love to do that. And one thing that I love that you make the point of is that everybody who came away from talking with Patricia Neal said, you know, that, boy, she just made me feel so fantastic, yet you really never found out anything about her. She just asked all about you. And, you find that really with so many of the people, I think, I don't even want to say entertainment, though, Stephen, because if you go and meet, you know, the President of the United States or, you know, heads of major corporations or things like that, I think the good ones do the exact same thing. It's like,
well,
they must learn it in school someplace.
I don't think it's a facade necessarily. Patricia truly was interested in other people. But like I said, Garrett, she had to relearn her life after her illness. And she relearned it, and her husband, Roald Dahl, wrote a speech which she traveled all over the country giving for many, many years. She was traveled with the Theater Guild on innumerable cruises, giving a speech called An Unquiet Life. As a matter of fact, when the book was ready for publication, the publisher did not like the title that I had given it. I think was calling it Patricia Neal, Portrait of an Actress. Well, that's kind of lame. I'm glad we were forced to change it. But, Pat, when I was reading the finished manuscript up at her home in Martha's Vineyard, I spent a week just every morning at 8 o'clock would meet in the kitchen and would spend as much time as she could handle while I read the manuscript, which was a little over twice as long as the book eventually ended up. And she told me, when I told her the publisher is unhappy with the title, she said, well, why don't you call it An Unquiet Life? And I thought, well, why don't I? She said, I will give this to you. And I really am glad she did. As a matter of fact, she changed the title of her speech as she continued to travel and tour, giving her story to various institutions and, of course, on cruises, et cetera. And she called it something else. I'm not for sure. I can't remember what she called it after the book came out. But she gave me the title, An Unquiet Life, and that was actually Roald Dahl's tribute to his wife. But she gave the speech over and over and over. She never tripped up, and that's it. It's etched in stone. That's how Pat remembered it. Unfortunately, during her recovery, there was a gentleman that was in England with Roald Dahl and Pat during her recovery period, and he gave an interview, had her give an interview, I think, to McCall's magazine, and gave some very, very major incorrect chronological information. This is what Pat Neal remembered, and she held to it. So when I was reading the manuscript to her, I think last time we talked about, she gave me something about Gary Cooper that I wasn't for sure she would be happy with, but she said I knew about it. And so I left that in the book, and in turn, there weren't any vanity issues, and she said that this particular episode at Warner Brothers did not happen. However, we talked about that, you and I, and it did happen, but in the whole scheme of things, it didn't affect her career, it didn't affect her life, and so, you know, she gave me Cooper, I took that out. But during the reading of the manuscript, when I came upon these chronological points with her, she was very upset about this, and I talked to her daughter, one of her daughters, about it, and, of course, I had the verification from USC. It was a filming situation, and it was right after the filming that she lost a child. So how do you tell a mother that, you know, your story is correct, your feelings, your memories are dead right, but these happened after and not before? So at any rate, there were certain things that Pat took with her when she passed away that were not going to change because she had to relearn her life. But also, she was also very, very interested in the fact that God had given her another chance to live those final years, especially after her divorce, to live those final years with a certain amount of dignity and peace. Mm-hmm. And she was just brilliant to be around and very giving. I know the first time I went to the vineyard and stayed with her, it was interesting. She took me upstairs to her home. She said, this is where you're sleeping tonight. And she had water by the bedstand, and she pulled the covers back on the bed. Well, this is a very Southern thing. This is, my mother used to do stuff like that. You know,
right.
She had company, you know, she would pull the bed linen back so that it was all ready for you to go to bed, and water by the bed. And I thought, well, you know, this it tickled me because these were things that she didn't have to relearn. Those were things that was something that was just intuitively, instinctively her.
Yeah.
And she could slip into her Southern accent at the drop of a hat when we were down south. If she was talking to somebody with a Southern accent, she could certainly slip into her Knoxville, Tennessee upbringing. But then again, she could also talk very British, high British, because she lived there half her life as an adult after she married Roald Dahl. And so it was interesting to see the various colors and the various aspects of Patricia Neal's life. Writing this book, I think anybody who wants to write a biography, I think they have to have in their mind what they want to do. I started reading film biography, adult film biography, and I think this is a repeat as well. When I was 10 years old and I was reading I'll Cry Tomorrow and Gerald Frank and all of his books, Too Much Too Soon, all these adult biographies, when I was 10 years old, can you imagine? And at any rate, these books influenced me. Also, motion picture, my mother was, when she was a child, loved motion pictures, and my dad too. He always wanted to be a cowboy. So at any rate, they watched a lot of films when I was growing up. So this was all part of my growing up. And I read, there were particular authors that influenced me a great deal, Alexander Walker and Barry Paris, his wonderful book on Louise Brooks. These authors, I read their style of writing, and anybody can accumulate a vast amount of research, 50 million pieces to the puzzle. Anybody can write a telephone book. Anybody can write an encyclopedia, but the trick of it is you got to make that narrative interesting. Somehow you've got to get the reader to turn the page. So I pondered every day before I started my work on my computer. I got my quiet time and just centered and focused myself. And I was always in school. I was always told less is best. So don't have these rambling four-page paragraphs. Don't have these rambling 232-word sentences. You know, less is best. And so you're right. I wanted to just, these are the facts, ma'am, but there are reasons for these facts. And I think anybody
right.
who has read, if there's, I think anybody who has read film biography and has been piqued or interest, their interest has been piqued by certain facts that pop out from what they've read. That's what I look at when I do research. I have never had anybody do research for me. I want to get in there. I want to get my hands dirty. I want to see everything that is total garbage to things that are just astounding so that I can have one little aspect. For instance, in Patricia Neal, when you read Patricia Neal, I have a degree in music, vocal and instrumental, and music's very important to me. So in Patricia Neal, there are, I always make a point of saying, and this film score was by so-and-so and so-and-so. And
mm-hmm.
I think one of the most beautiful scenes in any motion picture that Patricia was ever in was in a very small film. It was the third film that film director Robert Wise, who did The Sound of Music, the third film that Robert Wise directed with Patricia Neal, the second being The Day the Earth Stood Still, which might very well be, in some circles, the one film that Patricia Neal will be remembered for. However, there's HUD and The Homecoming, etc. But the third film that Robert Wise directed was a very small comedy called Something for the Birds for 20th Century Fox, and it starred Victor Mature, who actually happened to be one of Patricia Neal's most favorite leading men because he was quite a gentleman. I had the good fortune, as did Patricia, to meet his daughter at La Jolla when we did a book signing right after.
Oh, wow.
Patricia and I did a film together. It was her last movie for the Hallmark Channel called Flying mm-hmm. By, directed by Jim Amatulli with Billy Ray Cyrus and Heather Locklear. At any rate, that evening we finished the film. We appeared at La Jolla to do a book signing at D.G. Wills Bookstore, and Victoria Mature was at that book signing. And it's beautiful. Patricia teared up, and she was so glad to meet this child of her possibly her favorite leading man. Victor Mature and Patricia shared a very brief scene where they had some dialogue. And in the background, you could hear, "Again, this couldn't happen again." It was a beautiful piece of music. And it was so lilting, and Eloise Jensen had designed this gown that Pat was in, and the lighting, it was 20th Century Fox, the lighting was just superb. One of the most erotically beautiful scenes in any film that Patricia ever was in. And so I wanted to kind of put this music periodically in the book, as I wanted to mention about costume, and I wanted to mention backstory and films that she was not in that she was considered for. I've utilized this now in my other two books, Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr, and Gloria Swanson, The Ultimate Star. I've used those particular aspects of filmmaking, things that I'm familiar with, to maybe there is a reader that, oh my gosh, well, I didn't know that Nelson Riddle did this, or I didn't know that
right.
The score was by Max Steiner, or Edith Head did this gown. It's not a importante in the scheme of, you know, world history, but still, I put things like that in my book just to add a little color and just to fill things out, because like I said, I don't want a dull read, and I've had my fair share of dull reads. And also, there are many, many biographies that I have read that it's interesting. When I am in the process of doing a project, I have to be very careful what I read at night before I go to sleep, because I'm so scared, Garrett, that through osmosis, I'm going to, if it's a bad book, it's going to seep in.
It's going to soak in.
So, you know, I don't want to sit here and read Dickens every night, you know, for Pete's sake. But at any rate, there are certain things that work for me, certain things I do during the process of putting a book together, and things that I think the reader in who's going to read this book? Well, it probably won't be my great aunt Tilly or my great nephew, but who's going to read this book, and what are they going to want to hear about?
Right.
Well, you can tell the story over and over again, and you can perpetuate a myth. I try to get down to the nitty-gritty the first time story is told. Usually the first time a story is told in print, it's pretty darn near the truth. Over periods of repetition and time, those stories get exaggerated, they get switched, they get changed. So I try not to repeat a story, at least, even when I quote from a source, I try not to repeat the story if it's long of tooth. You know, if it was, you know, 1936 when she said this, then that's probably what she said.
Right.
If
yep.
this is what has been printed. So anyway, and I think we had talked one time, you and I, about the process of writing. Many times when I do my speeches and when I do my talks on my subjects, on Hollywood and Patricia Neal, people will come up and say, well, I've got a story, I want to write a book, I think it should be published. Well, everybody's got a story, and everybody should write those stories down. I remember after 9/11, I was in the city that day, and I think I had told you about this as well. I lost several colleagues in Tower One. Most everybody in New York knew somebody that had perished down there. And the thing is that instead of carrying that around with me, I went home, and within 2 days, I got it all down on paper, every thought, every sensory memory I had of the incident. And I printed it out, and my computer crashed that night. But at least I had printed it out, and I won't go down memory lane and reread it. But at least I have that, should I ever need to refresh my memory.
Absolutely.
But I don't have to think about it. So people should write down their stories. If they have an anecdote about their great-grandfather, I've read some people have been shoving their biographies to me over the years, and good, bad, or indifferent, the way they're written, the stories are fascinating, and those stories should be handed down from generation to generation until, lo and behold, your great-grandchild suddenly is an author, and then let them put that down into a book that is readable, concise, readable, and is finalized in print. Everybody should write, I think, and put their stories down. However, they also need to know how to write a book, and that means going to the library and picking up how-to books. And there's a whole litany of steps that I usually give people in private conversation about what I did to get my work done. And so I really appreciate it when people compliment me on my work. I love it when they adore my subjects, Patricia and Haiti and Gloria. I've got some more coming about. I love that they love them. It tickles me. I mean, there's a reason why I've written on all three of these women, because no definitive biographies had been written about those first three women until my books came out. So at any rate, I wanted to do a proper job with Patricia Neal. I think I did. I certainly did with Haiti Lamar and with Gloria Swanson. I believe I did as well. So that's not being egotistical here. It's just that
it's a fact.
If it works, don't fix it. And so
right.
You know what I do, my method, and the work that I do, it seems to please people. And this is writing. I've done many things in my life, many things in my life, and this is. These three books, they speak for me, and these are the things that I'm going to be remembered for, and the things that have made me happy, and people have been pleased with. So, you know, it took me a long time to get to that point where I could find my niche, but as a biographer, that is what I am.
Well, you know, you made the comment a few minutes ago about the fact that, you know, you do include, you know, who wrote the score or who made the dress or things like that, and recognizing who your audience is. And as, I think as a writer, Stephen, the great thing about what you do is you know this going into it. And, you know, if it's not your aunt this or your great nephew this or whatever the case may be, the people who are buying your book, Patricia Neal and In Quiet Life, they... when they see who wrote the song for that movie or who made the dress for this or the other facts that you infuse in the storyline along the way, these are the people who are going to go, oh, my gosh, I remember that, or I'm so glad that that's part of it. And I think the reason I like that in your stories is because you are really recounting in your own way Hollywood history. Through all the research and all the hours of blood, sweat, and tears that you put into your work, what you give us are... well, stories, but they're factual stories about what took place, and I don't think that there's enough of that.
Well, and baby, you better get it right, too. You know, there's nothing that incites me more to see a star, a producer, a film director, you know, a lighting individual, his name spelled incorrectly. There's nothing that infuriates me more than having the wrong person given credit in It tells me that the author has either not done his research, that he's just following the latest perpetuation of a myth, or he hasn't gone back to the source. There's a lot of work that's involved in doing a definitive biography. And, yeah, I remember when Patricia Neal, again, it was my first book, and I went to, not to drop names, but I'm going to, I went to Robert Osborne, and I said, Robert, I said, there's one word in the whole book that's really got me upset because I didn't put that word in there. My editor did, and it's a word that I don't use. The word is verisimilitude. I don't even know how to spell that word, much less really know what it means, but it stuck out so much. My sister, when she read the book, told me, what is this word on page whatever, whatever? Well, in the first edition, that book, or that word, verisimilitude, sticks out like a sore thumb. And I went back to the publisher. I said, boy, you better change that, because that's not the way I wrote the book, and people are catching that. Mm-hmm. I certainly caught it. But anyway, I told Robert Osborne, I said, as far as I know, there are only three errors in that book. Two of them are typo, and one of them I had mentioned Mike Nichols. I screwed it up, and I said Mike Nichols' first film was either The Graduate or Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, one or the other, however it was, and I got it reversed. So the second edition is proper. It's got my original words in it, and we gave Mike Nichols his proper first film. That humiliated me that I got Mike Nichols' first film incorrect. But Robert Osborne looked at me and said, "So you only had three mistakes? He said, count yourself lucky." So I don't know when I've, you know, this is Robert Osborne who wrote the definitive book on the Oscars, you know, but and over the years he's had plenty of opportunity, if he's had a typo or two in there, plenty of opportunity to clean that up. So I think his books are just pristine at this point. But I always, always just go over that manuscript and over that manuscript, and I work with the editors continuously. And I think when Gloria Swanson came out, one of the captions on one of the photographs, the name was incorrect, and I blew a gasket after the book came out, and I asked them to change that for future editions, and they will. But it just, you don't want errors like that. And even when the book comes out, I always read it, reread it, and reread it. Not because I'm just enthralled with my work, but because I just want to make sure.
You're critiquing it.
You bet. And it's very hard to let a manuscript go. It's very, very hard when you've finished a book and it's time, you know, after a year of editing with your editor, it's time to let it go. You don't dash reread it a 58th time because you're going to want to make changes. You have to let it go at some point and pray to God that you've made all the corrections. And even then, there are going to be, I'm very fortunate, I know how to dot I's, I know how to cross T's, and I try to make sure that I'm not repetitious in the same words, certainly in the same sentence, much less in the same paragraph, and particular words not on the same page. So I'm very, very careful, and I think anybody that owns a thesaurus can write a book, and I'm very, very careful when I do my manuscript so that the reader is not bored. The material might dull his senses, his or her senses, but the words are not going to bore them. And
I thank you for that.
I don't think I'm unique, though. I think some of the best writers are very, very careful. It's not easy. It's not easy. You hear growing up, oh, to be an author, to be a writer, is a very lonely life. Well, I don't look at my life as being lonely, but I'll tell you, sitting behind a computer from dawn to dusk during the writing process, it comes in waves. Sometimes you can't let it go. You're up very, very late because you know when the juices are flowing. And sometimes there have been literally days I can't get near a computer because my mind's just stuck on something, or I'm dwelling or debating. With Hedy Lamarr, when we talk about Hedy Lamarr, now there's a writing process. Hedy Lamarr, I finished that manuscript, and toward the end, the 11th hour, her voice came to me, and I thought, no, you're right. This isn't how it should be laid out. And so I went through it again, and I started pulling this, that, and the other. I mean, there's a whole process to writing a book, and it differs from author to author. And if I wrote fiction, it would probably, in my mind, it would probably be a much easier process because it would be my imagination. But you can't editorialize, and you can't let yourself step in to the story. And with Patricia Neal, Garrett, I think we talked about this last time. I had to be very, very careful not to write a fan-based book.
Right.
Because autobiography and fan-based books tend to give a one side. What an autobiography, the subject wants to leave behind what they want their history to read. So you look at that with a jaundiced eye. With a fan-based book, the subject walks on water, or in some books, in some cases, and I won't mention Kitty Kelly, sometimes they do what appears to be an assassination job, although Kitty Kelly really does her research. So, you know, I don't mean to talk bad about her, but a lot of people think her work is unfair. I don't think it is. I think she's she's just accurate. But what I'm saying is you've got to be careful on how you want to portray your subject. So when you tell me that when you're reading Patricia Neal, it's these are the facts, ma'am, that makes me feel good. You find it interesting and colorful, that makes me feel better. I am trying to tell her story from soup to nuts, and I believe that, you know, on all of my books, that's the job that I've done. That's the job that I've been called upon to do. I have mentioned Robert Osborne innumerable times, but the man I listen to, and I've interviewed him for all three of my books, and he's going to be interviewed for a couple more. But I've in conversation, he told me your job as a biographer is not only to just tell the life of your subject, but tell the reader why this life is important. One reason I do film biographies, as you know, is because film has created our society. My grandparents learned what the world looked like by going to movies. My grandmother told me her heart fluttered when she saw Rudolph Valentino. My parents learned how to smoke cigarettes, ride horses, and act like Joan Crawford. My generation, we were children of the television age, so we all thought our family should have been the Cleavers or the Andersons or you know... And so the children of today, I don't know, they all want to be the Kardashians, I guess. I don't know.
Ugh.
But the celebrity and motion pictures, the golden era of Hollywood, there was a glamour. There was a propriety there, even though there was a lot of sex, violence, and whatever. And Cecil B. DeMille knew how to put all that together with the wrath of God on top of that. But the golden age of Hollywood really created our society, the society that I was raised in, and the, you know, and maybe that society will be gone when I am, but that's why I write about motion picture and why I write about biography. These people fascinate. They're beautiful people. When I was 12 years old, my mother gave me her childhood scrapbook she kept when she was a little girl. It had all these pictures from newspapers and movie magazines, all these great big huge book of all these glamorous pictures of these beautiful, beautiful people. I was 10 years old, and I remember thinking to myself, I want to know about each and every one of these people because they were beautiful people. So I started watching movies, and I started learning about people, and then I started putting two and two together and kind of figured out, oh, this was going on in their life when they were doing this film, and this is, you know, and then over the years I read and read and read some more, and so this is how I've evolved into doing what I'm doing. When I met Patricia Neal, actually when I traveled a great deal with Pat, in interviews she'd always have me sit off the set in case she got tripped up on a name, because if she couldn't remember a name, we lost her. And
there's none better than you, Stephen.
Well, I could, you know, I helped her out a few times, and she could look at me, and I'd just give her a look, and she knew who the name was simply because of the look. We got to, you know, we could start reading body language real well. But at any rate, Patricia Neal, we haven't really gotten around to talking much about her life, but she had a wonderful life in the 1960s after her illness. She was one of the most admired women in the world because of her recovery. Can we talk about that?
Because we've got about 12 minutes left, and I would love to spend the last part of this show. This means we're going to have like part 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. But for the remainder of this show, I would love for you to share about what she went through with her illness and the strokes, and then did she share with you how her recovery changed who she was after that point, and also what kind of struggle did she go through? You know, given, you know, and it's not unique to Patricia, but to anybody who went through that type of recuperation in that era compared to how they do that today. I mean, what was that like for her?
Well, it was pretty much a new thing. People had suffered strokes, and before the mid-60s, there were no real programs, recovery-type programs, in effect at that time. Patricia was 39 years old. She had just won the Academy Award for HUD. She'd made In Harm's Way with John Wayne and a couple of films in England, and she was brought over to do a film called Seven Women, directed by John Ford. And within the first, she was 39 years old. She was keeping her pregnancy quiet. She was pregnant with child again. And she and Roald Dahl and the children flew to Hollywood and were staying at Martin Ritt's home in L.A. And when Roald and Pat's son Theo had been injured in New York in 1961, he had, as an infant, he was crushed in an cab. Jumped the gun on a red light and hit his pram and threw him across Park Avenue. That's four lanes. Threw him across Park Avenue and the pram got embedded in the wheels of a moving bus and the child was crushed. And his recovery was such that he had brain fluid on in his head and for several years. And so one of the doctors in Los Angeles who the Dolls conferred with, a Dr. Carton at UCLA, was an acquaintance of Roald and Pat. Pat came home from filming Seven Women after, I think, 5 days of filming. She had actually finished a couple of scenes, and she suffered her strokes and was rushed to UCLA, and Dr. Carton was brought in to relieve the pressure from the brain and to fix the aneurysm, which is a blood, like a blood clot, if you will. Mm-hmm. An aneurysm is actually a balloon effect from a vein in the brain that has burst. Dr. Carton was still alive at the time when I wrote this book, when I started it 10 years ago, and he gave me a marvelous interview, an in-depth interview, and he'd only been interviewed actually by Time magazine shortly after Pat's recovery. So this interview, he was very forthcoming in explaining, and he was the only person that insisted that whatever I wrote about this operation, that he see it first so that I got made sure I used the correct language.
Wow.
And so I gave him the two chapters, and he corrected them. We discussed over the phone, too, certain additional corrections. So my facts about her operation are true in that Pat was in a coma for 2 weeks. They didn't think she'd recover. Roald Dahl did tell the doctors and nurses that Pat was with child, so they put a lead apron over her when they did the x-rays to find out. So they opened up the left side of her head and removed the blood clots and sealed the blood vein. And as Dr. Carton told me, that each stroke victim suffers differently depending on the amount of blood that has been released. So no one knew how severe Pat was going to be. But when she woke up, when she came round, rather, she couldn't talk, and her body had begun to there's a term. I can't think of what the term is right now. But at any rate, she had to have... She was paralyzed, and so she had to have a great deal of physical therapy as well. The two nurses, Jean Alexander and the other nurse, that were at UCLA that were assigned Patricia, were asked by Roald Dahl to come over to England because he wanted, once she was able to travel, he wanted to bring her back to Great Missenden where they live. And so once they got back to Great Missenden, the two nurses took leave of absence from UCLA and came over to work with her. And they started doing a lot of therapy for her. There was a particular lady in the Great Missenden area who assisted in this. Her name was Valerie Eaton Griffith, and she herself had health issues after World War II. And so between Roald Dahl and Valerie, they developed a exercise program of mental stimulation. Roald knew that once Pat came round, she had to learn how to speak English again. And she also had to constantly, with the babies, flashcards and with the stimulation, there was someone with her all the time to keep her talking and keep her active. And then they started playing card games and this kind of stuff. Pat was very unique in that she was able to make a recovery. And within 2 years after her recovery, she performed again in front of the camera for The Subject Was Roses and was given another Oscar nomination because of that. Not out of sympathy, but if you ever see the film, she's brilliant in it. So at any rate, Pat had an endowment of sorts that she felt she had to give back. She told me this. She said that they came to her from Knoxville. They were going to put a wing onto the hospital in Knoxville, and they asked her if they could use her name in it. And she said, yes, but I want it dedicated to victims and people surviving, the families of surviving stroke victims. So the Patricia Neal Rehabilitation Center was her pet project to the day she died, and it's still there. She hosted golf tournaments. She would go there two or three times a year for fundraisers. I actually visited the Rehabilitation Center. Remarkable facilities, because survivors of stroke need to get back into trying to be as self-sufficient as possible, and this hospital pioneered that, if you will. Not many hospitals have taken that even steps further, but the Patricia Neal Rehabilitation Center is still a very vital institution for stroke recovery.
I am so
project. Yeah,
I am so impressed with that. You know, because again, I think over the years, you know, we've seen like the Elizabeth Taylors involved with, you know, AMFAR, and you have different celebrities involved in different causes. But this is such, you know, for people who have gone through stroke and are going through that rehabilitation process, it is tough. I mean, can you imagine, you know, here we are speaking tonight, Stephen, and then tomorrow something happens and we have to relearn everything that we've learned in our 29 years here on the planet. You know, it's that would be staggering, and you have no other choice because you have to do it.
Well, Pat felt very adamant, very, very sincerely about giving her time and her efforts to the rehabilitation center. She always made time throughout the year whenever they would ask to go there. As a matter of fact, the Patricia Neal Rehabilitation Center, the children were so very good. They gave all of Patricia's awards to the Patricia Neal Rehabilitation Center. There's a bust of her there, her Oscar, her Tonys, her Emmys. They're all there at the Patricia Neal Rehabilitation Center to let people know that this was a very, very important, if you will, woman who suffered a debilitating stroke and yet came back. So there's hope, and there's hope for the families. There's hope for the person living with the stroke. So this was very, very, very keen in Pat's mind until the day she passed away to give back. And I saw her in action. She was a very admirable woman. And, yes, we will have to do parts 3, 4, and 5 or whatever.
I think we're going to have to. There's just so much to talk about. Real quick, and not to cut you off here, because we are going to bring you back, and we'll talk so much more. So I'm just so, number one, I'm grateful to you for being part of the show. For everybody who's going to be on for the rest of the week, let me ask you this real quick, and not, I just like a 30-second sound clip. Did you watch the Bruce Jenner interview last week on ABC with Diane Sawyer?
I sure did.
What did you think?
I was kind of astounded, because I would have never thought when I saw him winning the Olympic gold that he would be sitting there changing the public opinion as he was that particular night. It was just, you live long enough, things happen. And I was kind of amazed, yeah.
I was kind of amazed as well. And tomorrow night we have somebody who I've had on the show before, but we're going to have her back on to talk about her journey as a transgendered trucker. Her name is Trucker Patty Spangler, and I say Trucker Patty because I'm just so used to calling her that, because when she calls into Sirius XM on all the shows that we listen to together, She always calls in. This is Trucker Patty, and she was a series. She was a star of a documentary last year that won several awards at different LGBT film festivals. But she's going to come on to give us her take on the Bruce Jenner interview and also talk about what's been happening in her life. She's also been featured in an episode of Glee and some other things like that. So I'm really excited.
Oh,
yeah, it'll be fun. Yeah. So everybody, Stephen Michael Shear, his Amazon author page is on the show page. Go buy all of his books tonight. Help support the cause. Stephen, I will chat with you post-show. And everybody else, please have a fantastic day, night, evening, wherever you are. Don't drive distracted, and we will see you live on Thursday with Trucker Patty Spangler, and she'll be talking about being a transgendered trucker. Have a great day, everybody.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Garrett. Thank you.